now. Eventually, using a combination of transactional trade finance, I cobbled together enough money, found a new supplier, and started again. I was not a woman who accepted defeat in any area of my life. I was not a quitter. The following year, in September 2002, I finally launched a range I was truly proud of. Clean, natural, and smelling gorgeous. Sadly, I had lost some of the initial orders from the year before, but nonetheless, enough of the retailers still believed in the new toiletries range and reordered in decent quantities. When my 30-minute spa ritual with lovely thalassotherapy toiletries, Bathrobics Beauty Spa, finally hit the shelves, the public response and press reaction was outstanding. I was delighted. Not expecting anything, I entered my beauty spa pack into the coveted Gift of the Year competition. To my surprise, I was shortlisted and invited to the award ceremony. When they announced I had won, I was truly stunned. It was a shock and a delight to be presented with the award by the lovely comedian Ruby Wax at the Savoy Hotel in London. A proud moment. Even though I'd kept my own health issues quiet, I still discussed the health-promoting effects of the products and the clean ingredients I was using. I spent time educating buyers from all the main retailers. One buyer remarked that I'd changed the whole course of the UK toiletries business. I'm not sure I can lay claim to that, but I was passionate about removing toxic chemicals from products. Get me going with a sales patter on this kind of thing, and it's hard to shut me up. Keeping the business afloat after its shaky start was getting more and more difficult. I could not afford to employ staff. I was swimming in paperwork, juggling manufacturing, sales, and PR, and was mad enough to create yet another two ranges, two rituals with a range of products for pregnancy, and then my Tranquility Spa gift pack. I was trying to run before I could walk, performing the jobs of 10 people. It was crazily busy. I needed a business partner, and I was desperate for investment. Andrew was too busy with his own projects to give me any assistance. Until my business made a healthy profit, he had to focus on keeping the log fires burning. Boots the Chemist had shown an interest in the range, but they were going through a merger with Lloyd's Pharmacy and could not yet commit. A major TV shopping channel was finally interested too. The previous buyer had held our meetings outside because she wanted to smoke at the same time, which I found incredibly hard, smiling sweetly while she puffed smoke in my direction. I had already met the new buyer, as her last job had been at Debenhams, where she had seen large quantities of my range shift in a sales promotion the year before. And I also had interest from a huge retailer in the US. I had travelled up to Minneapolis on the way back from a sailing event, and they wanted to pursue a line of products, but I knew I could go no further without serious investment. Chasing money now took up most of my time, when I should have been selling, marketing, and fulfilling orders. I was told that if you had orders from major retailers, then the banks would back you. But in reality, the banks gave nothing away. Not one penny. Not even an overdraft. How did anyone ever make a business work in this kind of stifling environment? The advice was to fold and start again. But that seemed too defeatist. I would still have no money. One morning, in June 2004, my bookkeeper came in and handed me the Evening Standard newspaper. She had spotted a small advert. "Look, a new programme on BBC Two for business ideas that need investment." Well, it could be worth a try. And so I applied for this new show called Dragon's Den. To enter, I needed to submit a business plan and cash flow forecast for 5 years, which I duly sent. A week later, I received a call and an invitation for an interview. Yikes! What had I let myself in for? I was like a lamb to the slaughter, entering the den. Having a terminal disease while being the sole business owner is not exactly a great selling point for getting investment, so I never said a word. Part of the entry process was a disclaimer to say I was fit and well. Had I had any major operations in the last 3 years? No. It was nearly 5 years. Had I suffered any heart attacks or heart conditions? No. Nowhere did they ask, have you been diagnosed with terminal cancer in the last 5 years? There were some probing questions about mental health. I can imagine that some participants are so distraught after their experience in the den that they suffer mental breakdowns. Yes, you could say I had suffered depression, but it was an entirely natural reaction to my situation. I was not going to describe my intense sadness as an illness. Had I known just how those dragons were going to treat me, their comments needlessly callous and cruel, I would never have gone in. I suspect this mean attitude was encouraged by the BBC. Mr. Nasty, a.k.a. Simon Cowell, was on fine form on X Factor, and Anne Robinson was Mrs. Nasty on The Weakest Link, both hugely popular at the time. Looking at the subsequent series of Dragon's Den, they were particularly mean in the first, especially the lone female dragon, Rachel Elnau. No sign of sisterhood from her. Dragon's Den was brand new. It was being filmed for BBC Two, in my mind, a bastion of old-fashioned English politeness and courtesy, known for their informative and educational shows. Surely they wouldn't be following the same armchair bullying technique, would they? This would be a proper business forum with proper business discussions, right? Wrong. This was all about viewing figures. Left in the wake of these reality programs are real people with real livelihoods, discarded callously without a care. Business owners left with battered and bruised egos and their confidence in tatters, a crucial ingredient for success in any business. If you have a business idea, my advice is to avoid appearing on the show, no matter how tempting the extra PR. As one of the first participants, I had no idea how grueling the experience might be. I had been interviewed by a BBC researcher holding a video camera in a side room the size of a shoebox at the back of the Beeb in White City. Not exactly great preparation. I was told very little, other than I would be presenting to five dragons, successful business people. I was told to prepare a 3-minute presentation about my business, and then I would be asked questions about the numbers, projections, marketing plans, etc. All fine. I had run off some cash flows with my accountant, and it all looked rosy. Except I was called by the BBC the day before filming and told that I had to change my projections, as the dragons were not going to invest £250,000, which was the number I had based my cash flows on. I was to ask for a maximum of £100,000. For a toiletries business that was already supplying major department stores, plus many other outlets, and looking to expand to the US, this figure was nowhere near enough. I protested, but they were insistent. I was cross that they were messing me about like this at the last minute. This meant changing all the numbers and reworking the figures by myself. I questioned whether it was even worth turning up. After making the adjustments, my turnover projections for the next 3 to 5 years looked markedly different. I arrived at the set by taxi, courtesy of the BBC, with a mix of unease and excitement. My worries were not helped by the attitude of the staff, who treated us like cattle. I was herded into a little room along with other participants, with hardly anywhere to stand, let alone sit. I sat propped on the edge of a sofa for about an hour before being called. The show was filmed in October 2004, planned to air in February 2005. None of us really had a clue about what to expect. There was a great air of mystery and trepidation. Once you'd been in the den and delivered your pitch, you were forbidden to return to the green room. There was to be no feedback as to how brutal these dragons were. We had no forewarning at all. As soon as you'd been expelled from the room, in many cases spat out, you were given a quick interview by Evan Davis, a well-known financial commentator for the BBC, then shepherded straight to a taxi and sent home. Before I entered, I was taken to one side and told I couldn't take all my products into the room, as they only had a small display table. What? How about all my press cuttings? I had so many brilliant quotes. OK Magazine, Cosmopolitan, Sunday Times, Daily Mail, Daily Express. The list was extensive. They had loved my products. Nope, not allowed. Really? How were they going to get an idea of the full range of my products and the public reaction with only a handful of products and no press cuttings? I was furious. This was a joke. I had also been told the only person who could appear was me. Not that I had anyone else to bring, but an accountant would have been good. I realized very quickly that the program was being rigged, stacked in their favor. I was going to be made a target. I was despondent. They were changing the goalposts as they had done with the cash flows. I had to make a quick decision. Should I go in? I was still confident that my products would sell themselves. There was nothing like them on the market. But I seriously considered backing out. I would give it a go. It would give the range a bit of publicity. And I knew I was not just after the money. I needed a business partner. Would these dragons be interested in knuckling down and getting involved in my business? I would have to make that judgment. How bad could it be? It was BBC Two, for goodness sakes. My 3-minute pitch, which was never shown on TV, had been perfect. But I quickly realized the blank faces in front of me were never going to invest. My business had historic debt. And with hindsight, it dawned on me that unless it was making a healthy profit at the time, or had a juicy patent they could acquire for almost nothing, I was wasting my time. Anything that required the slightest effort or debt issues was of no interest. I made no mention of cancer. The products were good enough to sell themselves without any of the emotional blackmail you saw on shows like X Factor. I certainly didn't want to share my health struggles with these obnoxious individuals. Rachel Elnar, the only female of the dragons, was the worst of the bunch. When I told them I had been unlucky with a bad supplier and lost over £120,000 of orders at a time when the business was just starting up, she had feigned sympathy, then tried repeatedly to push me to tears. I believe she was trying to show me up as weak. I knew her game. Had I not expected problems with the preservative? No, I hadn't. The tests run on all the products had apparently all looked fine in the laboratory. I had to have some trust in my supplier. I never expected to be delivered a batch of unfit, bacteria-ridden product. I had never heard of anyone in the industry having this problem. Also, I hadn't expected the manufacturers to then lie to me and tell me the products were clean, whilst they fleeced me of every penny I had. On top of this, the dragons all completely failed to understand that non-toxic toiletries without parabens, sulfates, and other toxic ingredients were the future of this market. I explained the difference, but still they just didn't get it. Rachel told me in a sneering voice, "The Body Shop have already done naturals. This market is already crowded." So instead, she probed me about my plans for the future. "How do you see your range in this competitive market in 5 years? I discussed my plans for expansion into overseas markets like Target and QVC and other marketing opportunities, and finished with one possible scenario, one I thought she wanted to hear, but was not necessarily one I wanted to take. "Well, I would hope to sell the range one day to a company like Estee Lauder or L'Oreal, like Jo Malone." Jo Malone, I think, had regretted her decision to sell out. "Who the hell do you think you are? You are no Jo Malone," she sneered. I was shocked at her rudeness. What gave her the right to decide whether I